I think humble curiosity at the core of your travel attitude allows you to find things that you never realized that you were looking for. Oftentimes, our expectations as travelers are so strong and so concrete that we forget that it's the things that we had no idea that we would discover, the things that we had no idea about the culture we're going to, that have the most, not just to teach us, but to reward us with the joys of new experiences.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles, into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
My guest today is Rolf Potts, without doubt one of the most famous modern travel writers out there. In his first book, the now iconic Vagabonding, an uncommon guide to the art of long-term world travel, he promoted the ethic of independent travel. It was released in 2003, and after more than 20 printings and many translations worldwide, had a huge impact on the global traveler scene and how we view backpacking and long-term traveling. Rolf also wrote for National Geographic Traveler, The Guardian, The New Yorker, and New York Times, and he has taught writing at Penn and Yale and the Paris American Academy. So as you can see, he is really the perfect guest to kick the show off. In our conversation, he talks about how he tried to infiltrate the set of the movie The Beach with Leonardo DiCaprio once, how travel as such has changed in the past decades, and how we can best overcome some common misconceptions that threaten to lessen our travel experiences. Have fun. Hi, Rolf. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. Thanks for taking the time.
I'm happy to talk with you today.
I'd like to jump into this conversation in the year of 1999. At this point of time, after many crossroads, you were in Thailand, and you were there while the movie The Beach was filmed, right there with Leonardo DiCaprio. And this film shoot turned out to be rather significant for your life. Would you tell us how?
Well, I had read the book The Beach by Alex Garland, and of course, Leonardo DiCaprio was the most famous person in the world, arguably. This was right after Titanic. And I had started my backpacking, vagabonding career at the exact moment that Leonardo DiCaprio was filming this movie, The Beach, which was kind of about backpacking and vagabonding. Not literally, but close enough. And I was really intrigued by the parallels between the story of the book and the story of the filming of the movie, because in the book, it's about a secret island that these travelers want to get to and nobody else knows about. Whereas in the movie, it was the most famous island of the world suddenly because Leonardo DiCaprio was there. And so I thought, what would happen if I sort of did the inversion of what happens in the book and try to sneak onto the island where this movie with Leonardo DiCaprio is being filmed? And this ended up being sort of a gonzo adventure that became an article that sort of kicked off my career as a travel writer.
So, yes, you did not only try to reach the island, but you actually tried to infiltrate the film set. How did that go for you?
Well, it was an interesting failure, I guess you could say, because I never actually made it to the island. And really, it's hard to remember now just how famous Leo was. I mean, that island was very carefully guarded. I actually paid a guy in a long-tail boat to sneak me there. And we were stopped by another boat. To this day, I'm not sure exactly what transpired. But I think that the guy who was taking me in his boat thought, well, it's probably in the best interest of this crazy American guy who paid me to take him to this island to just take him back home. In retrospect, I'm not even sure what I would have done had I snuck onto the island and just sort of walked out of the forest into this film set. I'm sure I would have been arrested or at the very least kicked off the island. So in a way, it was sort of an experiment to have an excuse to think out loud in my essay about what it is we're looking for as travelers and why is it that we want to go to places where no other travelers are? What is it that makes us want to go to these very special places in the world? That in this case, it was one that everybody knew about, but usually it's these places that nobody else wants to know about. So I was just able to look at the contradictions of modern travel through this probably inadvisable attempt to invade a Leonardo DiCaprio movie set.
And the resulting essay was, for example, chosen by Bill Bryson, pretty famous travel writer himself, for the inclusion in the Best American Travel Writing 2000. And as you have said already, it led you to do more travel writing. What do you think today made this essay special?
Well, I think it was a combination of drama and philosophy. It was the idea of a very headline-driven situation because everybody was reading about Leonardo DiCaprio every day at that point, but then also a much more quiet and thoughtful examination of what motivates us. In a way, you know, travel is an industry, and a lot of what is published in magazines and even online about travel is consumer information. You know, it's this place is better than that place, or here's where you can eat and sleep in this place. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it felt like one conversation that was not being had about travel at this moment in travel was the philosophical motivations. And there are these certain assumptions, like we do want to go to a place that we have to ourselves without other travelers. But why is that the case? And then also, if you look at the themes of the movie and the book itself, it wasn't just that the Leonardo DiCaprio character wanted to go by himself to another culture. He wanted to go with a bunch of other cool young Western people to a place that they had to themselves. So there's a lot of interesting philosophical contradictions that come out in the movie. In a sense, the article was a crazy adventure, but it also had another half to it, which was a more thoughtful philosophical example of why the hell am I doing this crazy adventure? And I think that's why it was so well received. In fact, that article is more than 20 years old now, and people still contact me about it. They still enjoy reading it. I did a podcast about it. And so it's sort of a fun pretext to explore these broader questions about travel.
And it was not the beginning of your traveling or your writing, but it was in some sense, I think, the beginning of you taking travel writing in particular much more seriously, right?
Yeah, you know, it sort of led to a transition into me being a full-time travel writer. I had lived in South Korea for a couple of years, teaching English as a foreign language, and I enjoyed that. But I had begun to freelance some travel articles, and it was sort of the perfect timing because I already saved my money, enough money to travel for 2 years around Asia and Europe, the Middle East. And then I was also transitioning to getting my very first bylines. And so the fact that this article was in Best American Travel Writing and was read by so many people really gave me a pretext to professionally change my focus. And while I was basically having this dream vagabonding trip that I had been planning for many years, it was also a chance to transition into journalism, into travel writing, into a whole new career. And it worked out really well for me.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a bit more about the genre of travel literature as such later on. But first, I'd like to get into what it was that prompted you to travel in the first place. What was your life like when you started to think about travel and especially about long-term travel?
Well, travel is something that I dreamt about when I was a kid, and I think most kids dream about travel. You know, it's in a category of things that kids dream about, of faraway lands. But I grew up in the middle of the United States. I grew up in the state of Kansas, which is about as far from a foreign country as you can get in the United States, and the United States is a pretty big country. And so there was nobody in that part of the country, nobody in my social circle who really took travel all that seriously. So when I was about 17 years old, I started to think that I needed to travel while I was still young. And my travel mindset wasn't very developed yet. I felt like if I traveled, it would be the only time I could do it. If I did long-term travel, I could scratch that off my list and then work hard for the rest of my life. And when I was young, actually, my grandfather, who I respected a lot, he was a farmer. He'd been farming since he was about 15 years old. He was getting ready to retire, but his wife, my grandmother, had Alzheimer's disease. And so he sort of had to stay at home and take care of her. And it's not that he had big dreams to travel internationally, but he just couldn't enjoy his retirement time in a sense that most people are. So I realized that you know, in American society, where you're often told that the time to relax and enjoy your life is when your working life is over, I realized that your working life doesn't necessarily reward you with free time. So I went to university, and then I got a job as a landscaper out of university, sort of a glorified gardener in Seattle. And I saved my money and I thought, I'm going to scratch this travel itch. And so I traveled the United States. It's been a little over 25 years ago now. Lived in a van. This is before hashtag van life.
yes.
And did my own iteration of hashtag van life decades before hashtag van life. And just had this amazing trip where it was easier, it was less expensive, it was less dangerous, and just a lot more rewarding than I thought it would be. And in some ways, psychologically, I've been traveling ever since. I realized that I didn't have to scratch my travel itch and take it off my list, but I could integrate travel into my life in many ways. Of course, when I finished my USA travels, I was out of money. And so eventually I moved to Korea, where working as a teacher got me money to do some more travel. I learned so many lessons living overseas.
Why did you decide to go to South Korea in particular?
I had some friends who worked there. They were university friends, good friends of mine, who are still good friends of mine. And they just reported having a really positive experience, you know, that they were growing in ways that they couldn't be growing in the United States, even if they had well-paying jobs. They just really enjoyed being in this new place. And so they actually found me work. It was nice that my decision was sort of made for me, but in a way it was a perfect place to go because I was able to make money. I was able to experience a new country that had some things in common with the United States, like Korea can be a very workaholic place. But culturally, it's very different. You know, we celebrate individualism in the United States, whereas individualism is sort of a bad word in Korea, where things are looked upon as more of a community effort and more of a family effort. And so I just learned so much. Even though I was experienced as a traveler in North America, I learned so much about international travel simply by working in another country for 2 years.
Was that in any way challenging for you to have this first in-depth experience abroad?
It really was. And I think that was good, you know, that Korea could be a hard country. And I often woke up very early and worked very long hours. But I think it was by sort of bumping my head up against another culture and how other cultures have their own assumptions and their own rules for doing things that I learned things in sort of a non-consumer way, in sort of a non-tourist way. I was forced to come to terms with how culturally different Korea was. And at times it could be negative and I could be a little bit depressed, but I think I just learned so much as a worker in a foreign country that I wouldn't have learned had I just been a traveler, had I just been vagabonding through Korea. I wouldn't have gotten those same instincts for navigating a foreign culture like I did as someone who worked there.
How did you get from there to wanting to write a book like Vagabonding?
Well, Vagabonding is probably, if I was honest about it, probably the 9th or 10th book idea I had going back to when I was very young. In fact, when I finished my North American travels, when I was still in my mid-20s, I tried to write a book about my North American travels. I really saw myself as the new Jack Kerouac. I wanted to write this American road novel or road memoir for the 90s. And it didn't work out, you know, in part because I just wasn't experienced enough as a writer. And I've said many times that was my graduate degree in writing, is writing a failed book about my early travels. And it was a chapter of that book that was my first real byline at Salon, which is where I later published Storming the Beach. And so it was a building process. And I teach writing classes every summer in Paris, and I often tell my students that you have to cherish those failures because you can learn more from an earnest failure than any class or textbook can teach you.
What was it that you struggled with in this book attempt?
I think I struggled with the idea of what is universally relevant about my experience. So I was talking about what I did, but I kept forgetting to make it interesting and useful for the person reading the book. That in a way I was telling my story without considering enough, well, why should the person reading this book take time out of their busy day to read my story? And sometimes I succeeded and sometimes I didn't. And that really flowed into the narrative stories like Storming the Beach that I was writing for Salon. But Vagabonding was sort of a different monster. It's more of a primer, sort of a philosophical guidebook to the mindset of long-term travel and the idea of time as wealth. And that almost happened as an accident. I was writing these narrative stories and I sort of assumed my first published book would be about narrative stories when through a weird set of circumstances, an editor at Random House said, well, why don't you take this travel advice you've put on your website, and I have had a website since 1998, and make that into a book. And I thought, huh, yeah, I'll do that. Because what had happened is that people, when I was traveling and writing for Salon, people would write and ask me about two things. One is, how can you become a travel writer? And the second one was, how can you travel for so long? Are you rich? And so I started giving travel writing advice on my website and interviewing other travel writers. But then I also gave some travel advice on how I could travel for so long. And to my mind, the reason I could travel for such long periods wasn't a practical thing. It was more of a philosophical thing. It was more embracing these ancient and modern ideas that help you understand that time is wealth and life is your only real resource, and that regardless of how you budget your money or pack your socks into your backpack, having this attitude that time is important was the most important thing for me. And I think that was the seed of what eventually became vagabonding.
And after all these years, do you get at all tired of being asked about this book again and again and having to explain its concepts again and again?
I really don't. You would think I should be, but after all these years, I think having conversations about it reminds me of how exciting it is and how excited I was to be writing the book and to living the book. Because I think life can be busy and you have other obligations and other duties. And so talking about vagabonding reminds me of why I wrote it and why the travel experience is so rewarding. So yeah, ask me in 10 years, but as of now, I'm not tired at all.
Great. So let's get into it a bit. You have started this book with a preface, and this preface contains the following sentence. Many travel books can help prepare you for an overseas trip, but this book, in sharing a simple and time-honored ethic, can teach you how to travel for the rest of your life, unquote. That sounds rather ambitious, right?
Yeah. And it's really tied into that whole travel attitude. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to encourage people, and I really envisioned my audience originally as Americans, and Americans have their own idiosyncrasies, and one of which is the idea that what you want in life, you buy. And so I really wanted to separate the notion that travel is a consumer experience that you buy and you slot into your life at a certain time of life, when in fact, with the right mindset, travel is something you can always access. You know, even at home, you can sort of embody an attitude that makes you more attuned to a place as you might be with a traveler. So from the very beginning of that book, I wanted to remind people that this isn't just about planning your dream trip. This is about planning your life in such a way that you can take a dream trip several times throughout your life.
And what are some of these aspects of this simple and time-honored ethic that you talk about?
Well, I think time wealth is a core idea. Mm-hmm. There's this idea, and it goes back to ancient scriptures, which I quote in the book, about how oftentimes we chase material possessions in life, and we assume that these material possessions are what we need to be happy, when in fact they become our golden chains, as the Hindu scriptures say. And then, you know, the Stoic philosophers from ancient times, the Bible, there's all of this philosophical advice saying life is more than just material possessions, and material possessions and luxuries can actually make your life less interesting and less meaningful. This is old, old advice, but we have not learned after all these years. So I wanted to find an internet age, you know, a postmodern way of framing this very old advice in such a way that people who dreamt about travel could realize that it's not that hard. The only thing they have to defeat is the mindset that makes them assume that travel requires a giant amount of money and that it is a lifestyle accessory rather than just something they can give to themselves.
You have mentioned time wealth quite a few times now. Could you give some examples of decisions in your life that have been especially essential to maximize your time wealth, also maybe regarding how you live today?
Sure. Yeah. The first thing that came to mind is I'm from Kansas, which is a very provincial part of the United States. And I have spent a lot of time in much more sophisticated parts of the world, including New York, which is one of my favorite cities, and Paris, and a lot of global places. But when it came time to buy property, I didn't try to find a glamorous neighborhood in New York or San Francisco or Berlin to live in, I bought some land in Kansas, which is my original home. I bought land very close to my family. And it is just so cheap to live in Kansas, to be based in Kansas. And one advantage is that I have a very travel-centric lifestyle. So often I'm gone at least half the year from my home anyway. So if I had a very expensive and small apartment in NoHo, New York, it would cut into my time wealth in a way that having 30 acres, having a nice rural place in Kansas doesn't. So I sort of traded being fashionable and being urban for time wealth. And so my home is a quiet rural place in a not very fashionable part of the United States. And the reward for making that decision is that I save so much money that I can reinvest it into time-rich activities like travel or writing more books.
Travel. That brings me to a quote in an interview. You have said travel should be an act of humble curiosity. And I think that's a very nice way to put it. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, it sort of flows out of the idea of you know, pushing back against the idea that travel is a consumer experience that you buy and then you are suddenly expect certain things to come with the fact that you've bought this experience. I think humble curiosity at the core of your travel attitude allows you to find things that you never realized that you were looking for. And it allows you to really focus your travels on people, which are the most rewarding and interesting aspect of being in a new place. It's a great place to learn, not just about, you know, the country where you are or the human condition, but to make friends and to, through these friends, find parts of these countries that you wouldn't have found before. And I think that there's so many ways that we can overthink travel. And sometimes in the United States, people put a political valence on travel and they think that by traveling, you know, they're exercising a part of their American self that makes them more broad-minded. When in fact, sometimes they're just bringing these political attitudes. They're not really listening very much. They're not really seeking these quiet, humble experiences. When basically, as a traveler, you stay quiet and let the other person teach you about their place. I think oftentimes our expectations as travelers are so strong and so concrete that we forget that it's the things that we had no idea that we would discover, the things that we had no idea about the culture we're going to, that have the most, not just to teach us, but to reward us with the joys of new experiences. So again, that humility, and it's hard to do, you know. At home, being humbled doesn't always bring rewards. You know, it's we try to be flashy, and even on social media, we try to present a part of ourself that isn't necessarily humble or even honest to ourselves. But it's through being humble and quiet and listening and being curious that really is the best square one. It's the best starting point to traveling in a more meaningful and rewarding way.
Yeah, I think it's very challenging for many people to get into this mindset, because no matter if they just have a 2 weeks holiday or they really travel more long term, today, if you do something like that, traveling, especially long distance traveling, you have so high expectations because of social media and many other reasons. How did you get to the point that you have been able to really exercise this kind of humility and also to take the time and to have the peace of mind to not hunt for the perfect moment or the one true authentic moment?
Well, I think it's a process. I don't think there's a silver bullet that you can shoot and suddenly put yourself in a new travel zone. Like I was saying before, when I was in Korea, a lot of my most important lessons were sort of humiliating lessons, you know, where I'm trying to learn this new language and I realize I'm using the wrong verb forms. I'm offending my host. But then I learned that people can be very gracious, that they know you're not, you know, in that case, they knew I wasn't Korean and that I was trying, but I was failing. And so I think it's being able to confront failure and to confront imperfection. And there's three things that I mentioned to people more and more in this day of where social media is really affecting our expectations. It's like be willing to be lonely, be willing to be lost, and be willing to be bored. Because having this basic computer in your pocket now, your smartphone, it doesn't allow you to be bored like travelers used to have to be bored. And it's through being bored that you that you meet new people and you try new experiences. Same with being lonely, even more so, that being lonely, instead of chatting with your friends or posting it again to social media, being lonely forces you to be more of an extrovert and to seek out new experiences where you are. And then being lost, you know, now you can have a phone in your pocket that always has a map, but sometimes it's by accidentally going to a place where you hadn't intended to go that you discover a much richer and more authentic, for lack of a better word, place of this new place where you're visiting. That you're, again, you're not the consumer who's going there to get what you think you were looking for, but you're wandering lost or semi-lost into experiences that you didn't expect. And often those experiences can be scary, but often they can just be very rewarding. And so those are counterintuitive things that I encourage people to embrace these days. That it's not bad to be lonely, lost, or bored, because sometimes that's a great starting place for a more rich travel experience than you might otherwise have found.
You talking about shutting off Google Maps from time to time makes me think of an interview I listened to, and you talked in this interview about your teaching course in Paris. You are teaching writing courses there. And in this interview, you talked about how you try to introduce your students to concepts for discovering a city like this from a new perspective. And I think you called it something like the psychogeographic travel or something like that.
Yeah, I talk about psychogeography. There's also the flaneur, and I apologize for my American accent when I say that French word, the flaneur. And the idea of the flaneur goes back to the 19th century in Paris, actually, though you can be a flaneur anywhere. And it just means not being utilitarian in the way you walk through a city from point A to point B, but wandering through the city, drifting, the dérive, as they say in French, drifting through the city in such a way that you're seeking experience. You don't know what you're looking for, but maybe you sort of know what it is when you find it. And so the flaneur is just a way to basically give yourself permission to wander through Paris, which is a classic city to do it in. And every year I have my students do flaneuring in Paris, but anywhere you are. And psychogeography is, I guess being a flaneur is a form of psychogeography. Psychogeography is a way of experiencing the city in a counterintuitive way by giving yourself new maps and new initiatives to the city. So you might say, I'm going to walk through the city, and every time I see the color red, I'm going to make note of that color, and I'm going to follow the color red through the city. That's called color tracking. I actually, in my Paris classes, I assign my students color tracking. And it brings them into neighborhoods and experiences that they would never otherwise have had. But that's just one psychogeographic experience. I wrote one of my books is about a gangster rap group from Houston in the 1990s. And when I was 23 on my first vagabonding trip, I went to Houston not through the tourist template of Houston, but through the gangster rap lyrics that I listened to at that age. I went to the neighborhoods that you're not supposed to go to in a city like Houston. And psychogeographically, it made the city much more interesting to me. And so sometimes you can walk through a city looking at automobile license tags and looking for a certain letter. And then every time you see that letter, you turn left or right. It's a way of playing games with a city, of playing games with your day, and really tricking yourself into letting go of your expectations and finding wonderful new things in a city that you might otherwise have been tempted to make small by your own expectations.
Is it correct to say that the word flaneur is kind of a variation of the term vagabonding, or at least that they share some similarities?
I'd say they share some similarities. Again, going back to mindset, the idea that you're not going to wed yourself to a specific goal. The flaneur is commonly thought of as an urban experience. It's usually a way that you find experience in cities. I guess you can bring the flaneur attitude to towns or other places, but oftentimes cities are big and anonymous, and being a flaneur in those cities allows you to break into new experiences. Whereas if you're in a village or the countryside, there's less anonymity, and I guess wandering is good, but it just has a different kind of potential than in a city. But yeah, I never have quite thought of it this way, but yeah, vagabonding in general, that mindset by which you decide that you're just going to embrace any experience that comes your way and not hold too tightly to your plans or itineraries, it does have a lot in common with the flaneur. I'll have to start making that parallel more often.
But vagabonding itself, of course, is not an invention by you, but it goes back at the core of the philosophy to people such as Walt Whitman and John Muir. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. You also mentioned them in your books. Who were they and how did they and their thinking influence your thinking?
Well, Walt Whitman is a poet, and he's a very American poet. He transformed in an age when poetry was fairly formal. His poetry was much more vernacular and democratic, for lack of a better word. And it wasn't until I started traveling that I realized how amazing his poetry was. He has a song called Song of the Open Road, which captures the vagabonding spirit in such a beautiful way. Again, talking about, he doesn't really talk about seeking transcendent experiences in famous people, but normal experiences in normal people and then finding transcendence within them. And then John Muir is a naturalist. He was a person who actually he blinded himself in an industrial accident when he was quite young. And when his vision came back, he thought, I need to experience life in a more in-depth way. So he just started walking. I think he walked from Indiana to Florida, and he really fell in love with nature. And he's responsible for making places like Yosemite, which is now a national park in the United States, famous. And he talked about time wealth. And in a way, Walt Whitman talked about time wealth. Now, these are very American guys. I'm a very American guy, too. They were both drawing on wisdom that came before them, from the Greeks to the Hindus to the Christian tradition. So again, it's not like vagabonding suddenly was invented out of thin air in the 19th century in the United States. But these guys, I guess they sort of had – they pushed back against the social idea in the United States. But this is a social idea that can happen anywhere, that life is about work and duty and convention. And they pushed back against this idea in a very beautiful way that really appealed to me when I was young. And so I draw on philosophy from them and from other thinkers at the time, not just because their ideas were good, but because they literally – changed my way of looking at the world when I was quite young. And for that, I'm grateful that I was exposed to them.
You said they pushed back against the social conventions of that time. Do you feel that this is still a little bit similar, that if you attempt or desire to travel long term, that this is sometimes difficult to justify in our society that promotes a more linear life quite often?
It is. It is. It's actually a little bit easier to travel than it was when vagabonding first came out, because we have the idea of digital nomadism. Are you familiar with digital nomads?
Yes.
Yeah.
But you can get into it a little bit in how far this is related to vagabonding if you want to.
Yeah. Well, it's I guess this all ties into the postmodern, post-industrial nature of our society, that it used to be that it was possible in a place like the United States to get a job and then have that job for your entire life, to have a sort of security. Well, in the post-industrial age, even if you didn't travel, even if you intended to stay in one town your whole life, the odds that you would keep one job your whole life is much less now. We live much more portable lives, and we live much more global lives. When vagabonding first came out, a lot of Americans, and I will admit that Americans are less globally minded than in places like Europe, they said, ooh, you say you should put your travels on your job resume, on your CV. I'm not sure if that's a good idea. Well, now people don't say that, because international experience literally is something that can make you more employable. Now, digital nomadism is something that came about in more recent eras. It came out of – actually, I looked up the Wikipedia for digital nomadism, and my name is there along with people like Tim Ferriss. So it came out of this sort of internet age philosophy that came from vagabonding in the 4-hour work week, that you can literally take your profession on the road, that if you have a portable profession, or if you can make your profession portable, then through technologies like Skype and other online technologies, that you can literally do the same job you were doing at home, but do it at a much more beautiful and enriching part of the world. You can work in Rio or Cape Town or other places you've dreamed about. And this literally is a thing now, that there are digital nomad communities. Now, I mean, digital nomads come up against the same temptations that a homebound person would be, is that, yeah, maybe you're in Cape Town or Rio, but you're working way more than maybe would make you happy, right? So again, there's no silver bullet that is going to solve your problems with work. But I guess it does push back against convention. It pushes back against the idea that you should live a very inside the lines life. Again, the temptation is that you might become a workaholic. You'll just be a workaholic in a different place. Yes. But it allows you to be free of sort of the – I mean, there's advantages to having a community at home and a structure around you, but sometimes that can be a little bit repressive and over-conservative. And so it allows you to get away from those expectations of home, wherever that home may be, and just sort of live in a place where you're free of those expectations and you can sort of forge your own identity even if you're doing the same kind of work. And so that's sort of a blessing of travel in this day and age, is that there are fewer excuses to not travel because there's evidence in social media and in the blog world that other people are doing it. But then there's fewer professional pretexts to not travel too, because you can literally take your job with you. So it's a fun time to be embracing the idea of travel, and specifically the idea of vagabonding style travel.
You say there are fewer excuses. What excuses are left? What are the most common doubts or perceived obstacles that you encounter by people who say they would like to travel, but for some reason or the other don't do it?
Well, weirdly enough, those fears haven't really changed. It's about money and safety. And, you know, I tell people that you can live more cheaply in a place like Southeast Asia than in this big American city. And people don't really understand that until they actually go out and do it. They don't realize that you can actually live a much more economical life while traveling than living at home. I can also give statistics that these faraway cities are actually safer statistically, or no more dangerous than the city that you're living in right now. And so I think that despite all of these resources that allow us to put our fears away, we're surrounded with enough people who will say, oh, that's not safe, that is too expensive, or that's not responsible. You have a duty to your community here. And it's important to just gently push back against all of those ideas, because, yeah, you know, I think there's reasons why people are afraid to travel. And sometimes people are jealous of other people who might travel. But as I say in the book, you don't have to travel to be the most socially important person in your home life. Just quietly let your dreams come true. And if you've dreamt of travel, there's no reason why these fears need to slow you down. So weirdly enough, the fears haven't changed that much. The categories of fear are the same, but the answers to pushing back against that fear is easier. So anybody who's listening and is getting this pushback from their community at home, or even has these fears themselves, in their inner voice, it's actually not that hard. Just do some research and you can find how safe and affordable and easy this kind of travel can be.
Did you experience this pushback yourself back then?
I did. I did. Fortunately, my family was pretty open-minded about it. I think in part because my family thought, I wish I would have done that. You know, I think sometimes you go through life and you don't really question these social norms that have been put on you. And when somebody that you know does something interesting like traveling for 2 years instead of 2 weeks, it makes you think, well, good for them. And those are good people to have in your life. And for that, I appreciate my family. But then there's maybe extended family or other friends who just thought I was kind of crazy. You know, they just thought Rolf will never get a normal job. You know, Rolf is going to go travel. He's going to sit on the beach and smoke a lot of weed, and nobody will ever want to give him a job. Well, that's not true. And so it's a good thing I didn't listen to these people. And that is one thing, you know, if you do travel in a smart way. You know, there's nothing wrong with smoking weed on a beach on the other side of the world, as long as it's in a country where you're not get arrested for that. But also be curious, because in a way, the world is the best education. That a vagabonding trip is worth 10 university educations, because there's just so much to be learned and discovered, often in a very humble and counterintuitive and quiet way.
Can you give an example for the counterintuitive way, what you refer to?
Well, I'll go back to Korea, because I learned so many lessons there that I thought I would learn like these hard facts about Korea. I thought I would learn the language. And I can still read and write Korean. My Korean language skills aren't very good unless I've had a lot of soju to drink. But the lessons I learned were these quieter ones, where I would spend time with my students and realize that maybe the relationship between men and women is more patriarchal in a way that I'd never considered. And that creates new challenges, but also new opportunities. for people in that culture. And then also, again, the idea of individualism and the idea that my students, they have duties. Like I oftentimes when I give presentations about vagabonding, I talk about how I learned of a dish called boshintang in Korea. And boshintang is dog meat stew. And that's very shocking to Americans. And it's not like every Korean eats boshintang. It's usually middle-aged men. It's sort of a macho ritual that it's supposed to make you more virile. But oftentimes Americans will go, well, that's not very humane. Why do you do that? And the Koreans will say, yeah, you know, my uncle eats boshintang, but what about America where when your grandma gets old, you put her in a care home and then you're really complimentary when you visit her once a month, you know? And in Korea, we respect old people. When they get old, we move them into our own homes and we make sacrifices to make sure that they're comfortable and happy. We don't outsource our old people to a business. And so that was a humbling and quiet lesson I learned. That basically, sure, they eat weird food in the other parts of the world, but they have relationships with family that are sometimes more nuanced and more intimate than we experience in our individualist information society. And so one of the reasons why I bought a home in Kansas, in addition to the fact that it's cheaper than living in New York, is that I'm close to my family. One lesson I learned from the world is that almost every culture in the world, even countries where people are very, very poor, they find so much happiness from being close to their family.
Especially in these countries often.
Yes, yeah. And they find kinds of happiness through family that we've forgotten. We've forgotten how to be happy through family in very rich and industrialized countries. And so those are the sorts of lessons that you don't expect to learn, but often can be the most affecting ones. And so even in my industrialized individualist country, and I'm still an individualist American at heart, I've made the decision to be close to my family because I learned some very humbling lessons from people who don't own much in the world.
Besides digital nomadism, how do you feel traveling and backpacking has evolved since you yourself started to travel?
Oh, it evolves. It evolves constantly. And like I said, it's become easier because no longer is a person like myself who grows up in a provincial part of the United States beholden to just word of mouth. You can go online, you can find out that there's other people who are 17 years old or 23 years old or 77 years old traveling the world and having a great time. And so it's really allowed people to be more concrete in their dreams. But then also that can be a two-sided coin to a certain extent that I think back when I was writing for commercial magazines, there was this idea that commercial magazines were giving us these narrow consumer options and they're being unrealistic about what travel was like. Well, now influencer culture on places like Instagram and blogging, it's just as dishonest sometimes that nobody wants to talk about the negative or difficult experience. They just want to show these perfect pictures and beautiful experiences, in part because the people living at home and dreaming about travel, they just want to see those beautiful pictures. And so in some ways, social media like Instagram has narrowed our conception of what travel is in ways that aren't always positive. You know, 20 years ago, we talk about 1999 when I was storming the beach. One place that I dreamt of going to that I didn't go to was Sumatra. It was part of the Backpacker Trail, the Banana Pancake Trail, the Lonely Planet Trail back then. And I wanted to go to Lake Toba and these other beautiful places on the island of Sumatra. And I actually went there earlier this year. And what I discovered is that there's almost no backpackers there. That these days, travel has become so convenient, it's so inexpensive to get an airplane flight straight from Bangkok or from Singapore to Bali, that people no longer travel slow overland through Indonesia. And I saw some other backpackers, but compared to what I thought I would find, I sort of had the island to myself, which was nice. But I think FOMO culture, that fear of missing out culture, the idea that, well, let's go to where the cool people go, has sort of found its way into travel in such a way that, you know, a young person who might have felt compelled to go to Lake Toba, Sumatra in 1999 now feels like, well, maybe based on Instagram, it's sort of cooler and there's more fun to be had in a place like Bali. And I'm not going to knock Bali. Bali is an awesome place. But what is subtracted from that equation is that slow, difficult overland trip where first they get their toes wet in Sumatra and then they go to Java and then maybe Lombok and then Bali. And so they miss out on all of these anonymous places that are not as famous these days because they're less likely to be seen on social media. So in the same sense that, that social media and online culture has made travel easier, it's also sort of narrowed our ideas of what is cool and fashionable and should be on our bucket list. And it's funny, the word bucket list didn't exist in common usage 20 years ago either. And one piece of advice I often give these days is use your bucket list to get out of the door. And once you're on the road, you'll find things that are so much more amazing that would be on your bucket list, because maybe 90% of your bucket list destinations are full of other people who are holding their bucket list. And that's fine to hang out with other travelers, but oftentimes it's that quiet little beautiful village or lake or mountain that wasn't on your bucket list. But because you got out of your house with your bucket list, you discovered it by accident, and that's what makes the bucket list so rewarding.
Especially if you put your bucket list together based on some, you know, top 10 lists from the internet, this often leads to, yeah, disappointment. And some travelers, especially those who have been on the road for a few decades, they actually, I find, regularly sing a little swan song about traveling. The former insider tips, they are now flooded by tourists because everybody has the same bucket list, and the cosmopolitan character of different ends of the world gives way to something like the world standard mush. Do you feel this melancholy about how the world has changed for travelers during the course of your traveling is justified?
Yes and no, because the same swan song, the same lament was being stated when I was starting to travel. You know, there's this idea that, well, we have the dial-up internet now and, you know, these phone cards, and pretty soon you may as well not leave home because we have this streaming real-time video of a place on the other side of the world. So I think there's always been an inherent pessimism that the places that you fell in love with when you first started traveling are now suddenly full of other travelers. And that's certainly one of the themes that underpins The Beach, going back to my Storming the Beach. That novel and that movie were very much about trying to find a place that hadn't been discovered by other cool people. And so I think what happens is sort of a ghettoization of travelers, is that travelers will cluster in one place. And in a sense, you know, if you really want a place to yourself, that's bad. But if you're willing to walk in another direction, if you're willing to be a flaneur, if you're willing to be a vagabonder and wander, then you'll discover what I discovered earlier this year, which is that Sumatra, this place that in 1999 everybody was being told to go to as a backpacker, is now a place you sort of have to yourself. And I think that there's a little bit of contradiction in the way people speak about losing these beautiful places to other travelers, because people, they want these beautiful places to themselves, but they also sort of want there to be other travelers too. So I think Bali will always be more popular than Sumatra because there's other good-looking young people there. And it's sort of fun to have other good-looking young people there. It's only when it hits a critical mass and it feels like you may as well be home that it starts to feel bad. So the good news I have for everybody is that despite the top 10 lists, despite the influencers standing in line to take their picture in these beautiful places, you don't have to wander very far to get equally beautiful places completely to yourself, even in this information-saturated era.
And even in the area of a tourism industry that is growing globally faster than ever before?
Yes. Now, I don't want to be a complete, you know, what's the word, Pollyanna optimist about things, because there are places, you know, I've read articles. Well, actually, we'll go back to the beach. Maya Beach, the place that I tried to invade in 20 years ago, they had to close it. So many people are going to Maya Beach because of the beach that it was overrun with tourists. And you had like a new market from China, not to knock China, but China's very close to Thailand. So many people wanted to visit that beach every day that it was becoming overrun. It was covered in garbage and it was just full of people and people weren't enjoying themselves. They had to close it down. I've read similar things about Venice and Barcelona. I've read things about Dubrovnik because of Game of Thrones. I've read things about Antarctica, that this market, this global market for tourism, which is really one of the biggest industries in the world, you know, it's up there with oil and other things that we consider industries, that it really does, it makes famous places a little bit less enjoyable. For example, I'm in Paris every summer. I tried to go to the Louvre several times this year, the famous museum, and it was full. Basically, the Louvre got full several days in a row in the middle of the summer. So I don't want to diminish how this can be a damaging thing, that over-tourism can be a damaging thing. But I think for every Louvre museum, that's overcrowded that you can't get into. There's going to be an interesting museum someplace else in Europe. And you might ask me, where in Europe? Well, I don't know. You know, you go vagabond, go flaneur, and you'll find it. Where you will find amazing experiences that are on nobody's bucket list, but can blow your mind. And I actually, in the United States, I live in Kansas. I live in a place that nobody would think to go. I often encourage my European friends to go to a place like Kansas, because with your European accent, with your German accent, people will take an interest in you. And you'll find the local community museum that has these old farming implements. And it's not the Louvre, but it tells a story. And then basically the director of that museum is so happy to have somebody from Europe in his museum in central Kansas that he'll spend some time with you. And so I think...
How many of your friends follow such an advice?
Very few. It's funny. Very few, because I invite my friends, hey, I'm in Paris every summer. Come see me in Paris. Tons of people visit me in Paris. Very few people visit me in Kansas.
But that's the challenge, isn't it? I mean, your argument is very good and your example is very enlightening as well. But it's very hard for people to follow this example.
It really is. And then what my American friends will come, you know, because Kansas has this reputation for maybe being a little backwards or over conservative, and they'll come and say, oh my God, I had no idea that this was such a pretty and amazing and nuanced place. And it's like, well, what did you do? You just came. All you did, you showed up, you know, it didn't take much. And so that idea applies to everywhere, that every place in the world, like my home Kansas, is more interesting and more diverse and more fascinating. Then you realize you just have to go there. You know, that's the thing, is that people are going to these top 10 list places. They're going to these bucket list places. And I'm not knocking them, because I go to those places too. But almost any place you go, if you go slowly enough, and if you listen enough, and if you're humble enough, it's going to reveal itself as a fascinating place too.
So our younger listeners, they don't have to be upset because it's too late for the real travel experiences.
Absolutely not. Now, it might be too late to go to Dubrovnik and have the place to yourself. It might be too late to get into the Louvre at 11 a.m. in the middle of July. But life is long, you know. You can go to that some other time. Go find a place that nobody ever heard of. Go find a village. In fact, you can get, for the young travelers out there, if you don't feel like you have enough money to go to the other side of the world and go vagabonding, go to the next village over. Go vagabonding in your own neighborhood. Go flaneuring in your own city. And that's good practice for the very tactics that can make these cities and regions amazing, even in the age of top 10 lists that would seem to dilute the experiences that we could have.
Why do you think your book Vagabonding has struck such a nerve and is still relevant today?
Well, I think because it roots itself in some timeless wisdom that I go to Walt Whitman and John Muir and way further back in history, and that I sort of distill old ideas into a new package. And I think that some of my early fans have also changed the way people think. I think of Tim Ferriss, who wrote The 4-Hour Workweek, and vagabonding was an influence on The 4-Hour Workweek. He helped introduce vagabonding to a whole new audience, that basically the hardworking business people who wouldn't go to the travel section of the bookstore would pick up The 4-Hour Workweek in the business section of the bookstore. And in a business context, he's bringing in ideas like time wealth to say, well, why should you work so hard? Why can't you take a mini retirement? You know, why can't you take your career overseas and live your travel dreams while you're making money? And so I think the philosophical ideas have helped make it a little bit timeless, but also the time in history when it came out. Like it in ways that I didn't realize at the time, when the book first came out, we were shifting into a more global and a more information-rich era, when where exactly you live in the world is less vital than the ability to communicate and use all these technological tools to be more mobile in the literal and the philosophical sense. And so I think it struck a nerve at a time when people were a little bit intimidated by technology. It reminded them that they can, in the face of this technology, use it to live a life that is rich in the way that people have always sought to live rich lives going back hundreds or thousands of years.
I've done a bit more than a dozen travel books of different formats and genres myself here in Germany, so I'm pretty interested in that. And I would like to get into writing and travel writing a bit to get your perspective, if that's fine.
Sure.
So how did you get into writing and travel writing specifically in the first place?
Well, it goes back to that failed book that I wrote about traveling North America when I was young. And writing is something that always interested me. When I was 7 years old, I wrote a book about dinosaurs, which is a very seven-year-old thing to try and write a book about. When I was in high school and university, I wrote sort of humor columns for my school newspaper. I wrote a lot of short fiction. And it was almost by accident that when I was young, I wanted to travel, and I also loved to write, and those two things sort of became wedded to each other. And so I wrote this failed book about my first trip. And it was through that failed book that I learned all my best lessons about writing. And then when I found myself living in Korea, I realized that everything that interested me about Korea and about the travels that came out of that experience, they lent themselves to travel narrative. And so I guess there was some intentionality in wanting to become a travel writer. And if you would have taken 10-year-old Rolf and said, hey, you'd become a travel writer, he'd be really excited about that. But part of it was accidental as well. It was just the fact that I was living my travel dreams. And at the time, I thought that it would be the last time I would travel in that way. The more I learned that I could travel for long periods of time my whole life, the more I realized that I could wed my love of travel with my love of writing. And that's sort of how I became a travel writer.
And what's your motivation to write travel literature? Of course, the obvious answer would be, yeah, I can combine traveling and writing. But
yeah.
Is that all?
Well, it sort of gives you an excuse to experience places in your own journey in a way that you might not have given yourself permission to do otherwise. It allows you to kind of be a protagonist in the story of your own life. And even less narcissistically, it encourages you to be repertorial and to meet people and to get their stories and to interpret other places through the stories of the people you seek out. And, you know, by nature, I'm an introvert. I don't naturally gravitate towards people. I'm a little bit shy. But as a travel writer, I have a pretext to talk to everybody I see when I'm traveling. And I can, as I'm being lonely, lost, and bored, I can use travel writing as a lens through which to make sense of the experiences that I'm having. So, you know, there's glamour that comes with being a travel writer, and there's pleasure that comes in the writing itself and being published and being known as a travel writer. But I also think it's a way to embrace travel in such a way that you don't become lazy, that you don't just let things happen, but you're out there trying to make sense of places. You're really seeing places as a mystery to be solved and experiences as something to be embraced fully, in such a way that you can write about it later in a way that might be universal enough to make sense to other people.
And what, in your opinion, can travel literature do in the best case? Which purpose can it serve?
Well, it humanizes these places. It holds a place in literature and journalism that falls in a very important place between panic-driven, you know, disaster, man bites dog type headline writing. And it's good to know about wars and disasters, but very seldom does journalism give us the pretext to just write about what life is like in an African village or a European city. That short of wars, disasters, riots, and strikes, there's actually some amazing human activities that are happening, and travel writing gives you a pretext to do that. It also allows you to sidestep that perfect vista, top 10 list, sort of marketing-driven trope of travel promotion. That oftentimes the travel industry, including a lot of travel journalism, is so wedded to the travel industry and, you know, the profits potentially therein, that it isn't really that honest, that it gives you a two-dimensional vision of what another place is. And oftentimes it's purely a consumer experience. And I'm not going to knock the consumer experience, because travel is a big industry and it's good that people are having experiences and making money. But there's a much richer and more human experience. And I'm not going to go so far as to say that travel writing will help bring world peace. I mean, this isn't the Miss Universe competition, but it actually it can humanize other places, that in a way that suddenly you're reading a travel book about a person. You know, maybe an American person or German person goes to a place that you've never been, and suddenly you're understanding this place in a human way that you wouldn't have considered otherwise. For my own podcast, I just interviewed a Doug Bock Clark, who wrote a book about the Last Whalers. It's about these people in Indonesia who they still hunt whales for a living. They're one of the last subsistence hunting cultures in the world. And one of the great things about that book is that he makes them seem like normal people. You know, he doesn't make them seem like exotic tribespeople on the other side of the world, even though they kind of are to our understanding. But he makes them about, you know, as people who are making rational choices in their lives. And I think the best travel writing can do that, that it can charm the reader and bring them into a part on the other side of the world, even if that means invading a Leonardo DiCaprio movie. And then bring them into the culture or into the texture of that culture in a way that can broaden their understanding of the world in a way that tourist advertising and panic-driven news cycles do not.
And I think that what you just described is a very difficult thing to do, right? So what? Let me ask you, what is important to you when you write travel stories? Under which circumstances do you say, after completing a text, yes, this energy and time I've spent on this was worth it?
Well, that's you might relate to this as a writer. That can be a torturous process sometimes. There can be a lot of pessimism and self-loathing in the early processes of the story, because you don't just want to capture other people's stories on the other side of the world. You know, you don't want to be didactic about it. You want to also charm the reader and convince the reader that this is going to be fun, that this is going to be interesting and enlightening and educational. And so oftentimes when I can find a mix of fun and education, for lack of a better word, of having a journey that sweeps you up in the specifics of the journey, but also leaves you thinking about the world in a broader way, that's when I'm happy about my travel stories. And it doesn't always happen. You know, sometimes I just do write a consumer travel article, or I do write maybe a little bit of a navel-gazing article where maybe it's too much about myself and not that much about other people. When I find that balance that really makes me happy, it's when I can find a way to bring the reader into an adventure where they have fun and maybe they feel happy or scared or confused in the same way that I was as a traveler, but they also leave the story feeling like they understand the world a little bit better in a way that makes the world more human and more interesting and more welcoming.
And probably this expectation you have towards yourself, it differs probably quite a bit between commissioned work and your own project.
For sure, yeah. In fact, commission work can be frustrating sometimes. I once went on a National Geographic Traveler story to the Falkland Islands. I pitched a story about the wildlife there because when Charles Darwin went there, he visited the Falkland Islands along with the Galapagos on the other side of South America. Well, when I got there, I thought it was the humans were more interesting to me. You know, it was like this little England. It was English in a way that England was in maybe the 1950s, in a way that England isn't anymore. So I wanted to write about that. And my editor said, no, you pitched a story about wildlife and we want a story about wildlife. And so that was, it's very logical that, of course, they wanted what I had pitched to them. But what captured my imagination was something I couldn't write about because I was on assignment. And so it's usually the articles that I make less money on, like those salon articles I was writing early in my career, that allow me to really stretch the potential, the thematic potential of what I can write about. And again, it goes back to that. I've used this word a lot. I've used the word time wealth a lot, but I've also used the word commercial. And I want to knock commercial travel writing, but when it's geared towards a potential consumer experience, then it becomes a little bit more generic and less personal and less likely to connect to these great human themes that can make travel writing really great.
What are some of the more common misconceptions of the glory and the glamour of travel writing as far as you are concerned?
There's so many because people just superimpose their last vacation on what you do for a living, you know. So there's this idea that you're drinking cocktails on a beach, flirting with beautiful women, and writing articles about it, when in fact it's very much work. And a lot of the work is done back at home at your desk when you're researching, you know, documents and histories. Travel writing is very much a generalist's pursuit, that we can draw on anthropology and we can draw on biology and culture and history and fashion and architecture. There's nothing that really limits what you can write about, which is a great freedom to have, but it also makes it difficult to decide what exactly is going to be the best vessel for your story. And so I always tell people, if travel writing was easy, then who wouldn't become a travel writer, right? And so it's very competitive. It doesn't always pay very well. It's very rewarding, but in a way that while those people are flirting with beautiful people and drinking cocktails on the beach, you're back at your hotel transcribing your notes and looking for new angles into this beautiful part of the world. And so I guess it's like travel itself. It's image versus reality. It's expectations versus reality. And so people idealize travel writing, and I'm not going to knock travel writing because I love doing it. But I love doing it because I love writing and I love researching. I love struggling alone in a room with trying to make a story the best it can be, in addition to exploring these other cultures. I've been interviewing travel writers on my website for almost 20 years now. And people will say again and again that the travel part is less important than what you bring with you to the travel part. That you have to travel well as a travel writer. You have to really find a new way to experience a place. But the hard work of travel writing happens in the writing itself. It's what makes the difference, and it's what people don't realize is essential.
When on the road, how do you search for material or experiences or moments to distill into a story?
I wish I had an easy answer for that. Sometimes it's going to the place, those bucket list places that I thought I should go, and trying to find a wrinkle, trying to find a nuance, trying to find something that's interesting there. Sometimes it's a matter of flaneuring, a matter of wandering and going off the path of where I thought I was supposed to go and asking questions of people who are there and finding interesting people. One advantage I've always had as a travel writer, and if you read my second book, Marco Polo Didn't Go There, which includes the story Storming the Beach, you'll see how this happens, is that for whatever reason, maybe because I'm an introvert, like the strangest, most idiosyncratic person in a village, and it's usually a man, will seek me out. And maybe this person has, like, their children don't listen to them anymore, and their wife and their neighbors are tired of listening to this person. And they're the strangest person in town, but they corner me and they find me, and they actually become an interesting lens into a place. So sometimes strange people have given me good stories. Sometimes kids have given me good stories. Joining a soccer game in Cambodia can be as fun as going to Angkor Wat. So again, I wish there was a formula I could give, but sometimes the easiest thing is just letting go, but paying attention and listening. And as a traveler, as a narrative traveler, learning to read landscapes and groups of people in such a way that you can see where the story is. Sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong. It's not always successful, but it's always an interesting way to travel.
A question to you as a travel writer, but also as someone who gives more or less coaching advice through the book Vagabonding. If we think about CO2 emissions by planes and crowded landmarks and more tourists globally each year, should we continue to travel and should we continue to encourage others to travel as well?
That's a good question. It's a very relevant question. I mean, we're historically living in a strange time. Interestingly, once I got that question in Melbourne, I was speaking at a travel writing conference in Melbourne, and I asked the person who asked the question, and I asked a show of hands, how many of you people flew here for this conference? And it was about, probably more than half the people had flown for this travel writing conference. And then I asked people, a show of hands, how many people fly just for business? And again, more than half the people fly for business. And so I think numerically, the people using all of these emissions through airplane flights are not vagabonding travelers. That oftentimes, if you travel the world slowly, you might take a few flights to cross a few oceans, but you're traveling in local economies and you're traveling slow in such a way that you are not taking a disproportionate share of your CO2 emissions. And I've actually talked to people who say, yeah, actually, I traveled the world for 2 years and I flew less than when I was a management consultant or whatever back home. So realize that while the CO2 question is an important one, there's nuances therein. And there's ways to, I guess it's sort of a self-congratulatory way to answer the question, but vagabonding can literally be the solution, that literally you can spend a year in the world and fly less often than you do employed at home. So just acknowledge that that's a real thing, that you can actually live a life of travel in a way that is more environmentally responsible and sustainable than you and your neighbors live at home in a major world city. Again, it's one of those, there's no silver bullet to that thing. I think the environmental question, the global warming question, or the climate change question has so many data points and is so complicated that it's hard to answer it in a glib and simple way. But know that you can be a responsible traveler in the vagabonding sense environmentally, and it just means going slow. And going slow as a traveler has so many rewards, not just environmental. The rewards of traveling slowly touch every part of the travel experience.
Do you consider yourself a lifetime traveler? And if so, what does that mean to you?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Lifetime traveler, I'm not sure what that means to me, because in a sense, I could have been a lifetime traveler without having left the United States. You know, I could have been because I'm a person who believes that travel is an attitude, right? So if I was a flaneur at home, if I traveled my own country in an open-ended way, if I kept that spirit of humility and curiosity, I could be a person who travels in a meaningful way at home. As it happens, I've become a global person, and I've become a lifelong traveler in the very literal sense, you know, that in a week I'll be in Los Angeles, and a few months after that I might be in Thailand. That literally travel has become so central to how I live that it's almost impossible not to define myself as a lifetime traveler. Now, I might point out that just because I travel all the time, that doesn't – people get competitive sometimes with the idea of travel, and that is not a very constructive way of seeing things. Like, just because I travel 6 months a year doesn't mean that I won travel, right? That yes. Someone can be a lifetime traveler and maybe go overseas once every 2 or 3 years, and they are just as legitimately a lifetime traveler as me or someone who hasn't been to their home country in 10 years. So I think really being a lifetime traveler isn't how many stamps you have in your passport. It isn't having gone to more places than your neighbor. It's about maintaining that attitude of openness, curiosity, and discovery, even if the farthest you travel every year is 20 miles outside of your hometown. So I like to hope that in both senses of that, I will remain a lifetime traveler.
And I think that's almost a very good way to conclude this conversation. But to really conclude it, I would like to do a little lightning round of questions, if you are fine with that.
Sounds good to me.
So what's your advice to people who are not able or don't want to travel long term, but 1 or 2 weeks at a time?
I'd say don't worry about the people who are traveling long term. Again, it's not a contest. Your neighbor might be on a 1 year vagabonding trip around the world. If that doesn't appeal to you, take a vacation, drink Mai Tais on the beach, get a suntan, put it up on Instagram and impress your friends. I'd like to think that even though I'm a firm believer in the idea that vagabonding travel is very rewarding, if it doesn't interest you, that's fine. Be a vacationer and enjoy your life.
What would you do if you were only allowed to take one more trip?
Well, I'm tempted to say I'd take a 20-year trip, right? I'd go over where in the world that I would dream about. Wow, that's a tough question. What a sad thing that I could only take one more trip. And one complication is, would I go to a place that I've been to before and that I love, or would I go to a place that I've never been before but I've dreamt about? And it would probably be B. I would probably take a trip. Maybe I'd find a way to take a round-the-world trip going to places that I haven't quite been to. In part because, like this year, I went to Sumatra. It's a place I dreamt about 20 years ago, and I was just so happy that I finally went there. I could have gone back to Thailand, which is a place I know well. It's where I wrote Vagabonding. But just the newness and unfamiliarity and vulnerability that were involved with being in this brand new place were so rewarding. So my short answer would be a trip around the world, dipping my toe into a lot of places that I've dreamt about but haven't gone yet.
What's your definition of an adventure?
Well, as I say in the book, an adventure is embracing the unexpected, even if it just means going to a bus station and going to a little village on the bus schedule that you'd never heard of before. I think all too often we have this consumer idea that adventure is jumping out of airplanes or rappelling down cliffs, which is great. I don't want to knock that. I don't want to disparage people who literally jump out of airplanes and climb mountains. But I think sometimes embracing the unexpected, even at a very small level, is a truer adventure than a merely physical pursuit.
Almost done. What do you consider your greatest success so far?
Well, the thing that popped into my head, I think it's a Henry David Thoreau quote, is my greatest success has been wanting little. in a way, that feels like my success too, is that, again, it goes back to this idea of time wealth, that my greatest success is that I've managed to avoid a materialistic way of being in the world, and I've managed to be experiential in that sense. But maybe also a success has been continuing to be a student and a beginner, and not being so full of myself that I consider myself to be an expert. And I guess in a certain sense, I'm an air quotes travel expert. But when you think about it, travel is so tied into unfamiliarity and vulnerability that if you get too tied into your identity as a travel expert, then you'll forget that what makes travel amazing and useful is being vulnerable and not being an expert and making mistakes and being a fool sometimes. So I think maybe wanting little and being willing to be a fool, those are my successes.
Last question. What do you think and feel when you think about the future today?
Well, perhaps counterintuitively, I think I'm optimistic. You know, I think that there's always ways to be pessimistic about the world, to despair at things like what's happening with climate change, at what's happening in the world of politics. But at a quiet sense, my experiences from travel have always been positive and have always been optimistic. I'm also a little bit older. I wrote Vagabonding. Gosh, when I started writing Vagabonding, it was not quite 20 years ago, but maybe 17 or 18 years ago. And I was in my late 20s. Now I'm in my late 40s. And so when I think about, I think one blessing of life is that it keeps giving you a different lens through which to see the world as you get older. And so I probably won't travel the world like I did in my 20s. And as I move before too long into my 50s, I want to continue to embrace the world in new ways. And again, not be afraid of being a beginner, because I think as Heraclitus said, we never step in the same river twice. And I look forward to having my travels in my 50s be as rewarding, as educational as those travels in my 20s.
I hope that becomes true for you. And most of all, I thank you so much for this conversation and for taking the time. It's an early Sunday morning for you in my place. Now it's early afternoon. It was really time well spent for me. And I thank you for the time that you have made.
Yeah, well, thank you for talking, and good luck in your own journey, Eric.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.